Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we have on the show with us Monty Messix from the band DFL. Now I'm going to give you 60 seconds to remove any kiddos from the room before I say the full name of this band, but this is definitely a story you want to hear. DFL is a killer hardcore punk band who started off as a side project with a couple of the Beastie Boys. Today, Monty tells the story about what it was like to start a band with Adam Horovitz and Mike D, what the scene was like for them, their transition to Epitaph Records, and the recent re-release of the Proud to Be DFL LP on vinyl. There is lots to cover today, and who do we have to thank? Groove Washer, of course. Groove Washer is the ultimate manual record cleaner on the market. Those cheap bottles you get on eBay are crap. Get the original, get the Groove Washer record cleaning kit today, starting at only $29.95 from groovewasher.com. And with that, let's talk about an incredible time in the history of music when the Beastie Boys moved to the West Coast, started a record label, opened a recording studio, and began a punk rock project. It's the Vinyl Guide's interview with Monty Messix from DFL.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, hey, that's me. Hey, everyone. It's Nate here, host of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Welcome, all ye record maniacs. This is your home. We are your people. Thanks for joining us. Hi to all the regular listeners who are out there. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for all the kind words you guys generally send me. I get mostly kind words. I get a few alternative words thrown at me, but that's okay. And hey, welcome to all the new listeners. This is episode number 95, so if you're new to the show, well, you've got a ways to catch up, but that's okay. You could jump around a bit. We've been having some great interviews on the show recently. A couple weeks ago, we had Ian Gillan of Deep Purple. He came on and had quite a lot to say about his history and playing with Black Sabbath and his thoughts on Ritchie Blackmore and, of course, the new Deep Purple album. We had Steve Albini on recently, and he talked about production for all the jillions of awesome bands he's worked with. Vernon Reed of Living Color came on to talk about their new album, Shade. It's a great album. And lots of things have been happening. So it is episode number 95. We've got a heap of great guests coming up. We also have episode number 100 coming up, which we are totally stoked about. So make sure your subscription settings are set for that. By the way, if you have an Android phone or you're listening on an Android operating system, we now have a Vinyl Guide app. Makes it a lot easier to listen to this podcast. So if you're interested in getting that, it's free. And it makes things easier for you. So just head over to thevinylguide.com, click on the black button that says get it on Google Play, and that'll take you straight to the download page. You can get the app. It's free and easy and works great. And by the way, if you are a fan of DFL and or hardcore punk music, we have a bunch of episodes of The Vinyl Guide you'll probably enjoy. Again, they're totally free. They're available at thevinylguide.com or through any of the podcast apps, through our Android app. We have an iPhone app coming up, or any, you know, you can go to your podcast app and download some of these. Here are a few that you may be interested in. Keith Morris, Black Flag, Off, Circle Jerks. He came on the show to talk about some crazy punk rock stories and his life, episode number 56. Fat Mike of NoFX and, of course, Fat Records. That was a very vinyl-heavy conversation as well, but, of course, there's plenty of, wherever Fat Mike goes, he's got crazy stories as well. That's episode number 51 of The Vinyl Guide. Wayne Kramer of the MC5. He came on episode number 45 and talked about the history of Kick Out the Jams and some of the crazy stuff that he got involved in. Tesco V of the Meatmen, Tesco V's Hate Police. He started Touch and Go Records, and he told a lot of stories as well. Episode number 39. Recently, we had Buzz Osborne from the Melvins come on, episode number 67. Lots of episodes there, lots of interviews, conversations, not just with punk rock royalty, but all sorts of other musicians. Make sure to subscribe to The Vinyl Guide. All of this is always free and totally open for you guys to enjoy. Now, speaking of great guests, last week we had on the show Dweezil Zappa. And Dweezil and I had a conversation about the work of his father and how he related to it all growing up in the Zappa household. That was definitely a unique experience that he was sharing. And we decidedly kept the discussion about music, which is exactly what both of us wanted. There's lots of drama happening in the Zappa universe, if you're not aware of it right now. There was a recent announcement of a touring Frank Zappa hologram, which has really divided the Frank Zappa fans. They either love the idea or hate it. There's the continued bickering and legal shenanigans between the siblings, and it's really getting ugly. They need to sort that out soon. It's been very, very divisive. I actually personally got kicked off of one of the main Zappa forums last week simply because I interviewed Dweezil. And the forum admin, well, she decided to choose sides in the matter, and it's really lame. Frank would have absolutely hated this. But the good news is that we only spoke to Dweezil about the music, not about all the legal circus that they have going on. So if you haven't heard the episode yet, go back and enjoy last week's interview of Dweezil Zappa on thevinylguide.com. Now, this week on the show, we have Monty Messix of the hardcore punk band DFL, or Dead Fucking Last. That's what it stands for. Now, I gotta tell you, I love this band. I have since my youth. Their music is fast, it's fun, it's liberating. It comes from a place of energy and goodwill. There's absolutely no pretension in DFL's music, which is probably why the band is still revered today. Now, if you don't know about them, you don't know their story, I think you're still going to be very, very interested. DFL started as a side project with a couple of the Beastie Boys. And this is Beastie Boys when they were at the top of their fame. And Monty's going to discuss all about that time today. DFL went on to record three great albums. There's My Crazy Life, Proud to Be, and Grateful, which I consider essential punk rock listening. Only one of the albums is available on record today, which is Proud to Be, and it's available from Epitaph on this bright green vinyl. This is a recent re-release. The original release was called Tony's War. It was on 2 7-inch records. You can find those around for about $40. I highly recommend finding copies of these if you can. It's about to become quite collectible and hard to find. Now, you'll learn more details about that record today. So before we start this interview and let Monty tell this incredible story, DFL has two things they want you to know about. Number one, they are working on a new album with Greg Hetson producing it. Now, you guys know Greg from Bad Religion, Circle Jerks, and about 50 other punk projects. This is awesome news. I cannot wait to hear the new tracks. Again, that's discussed today, and you can hear more at their Facebook page, facebook.com/proudtobeDFL. The second thing is DFL is re-releasing the Grateful album as The Tape Show. It's a re-release on Burger Records. Now, this is a cassette. It's ready in time for Cassette Store Day, which is October 14th, I believe. Look, that's really all I know about Cassette Store Day. I know about Record Store Day, but with cassettes coming back, well, apparently now they have their own day, which is fantastic. So good luck, cassette collector peoples. Make sure to, again, like the facebook.com/proudtobeDFL page. You'll get all the latest DFL news and where you can pick up a copy of the Tape Show re-release on Burger Records. All right, with that, let's get to our interview. This is a great one. Sit down, get your coffee ready, your beer ready, your whatever you're drinking. Relax and enjoy our interview with Monty Messix of DFL. Today on the show, I'm totally excited. We have with us Monty Messix from the hardcore punk band DFL, or Dead Fucking Last. In my opinion, one of the great punk bands from that second wave, or maybe his third wave by the time it came around, in the mid-90s, and their music still gets my blood going today. Monty, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing great, man. Glad to hear your voice. You sound just like the guy on the records that I like.
Ah, thank you.
It's good. You've got that tone, that unmistakable DFL vocal tone. This is going to be fun. First off, the band name, Dead Fucking Last, great name. Who came up with that?
Actually, I came up with it. It was just an idea that popped into my head, DFL, back in the early 90s. Yeah, it's actually a sailing term that I heard when I was visiting my dad in Maine, and it was a term for, believe it or not, when a sail, they would have like these races, these sailboat races, and they would say when it was like the last sailboat to come across the finish line, they would say that boat was DFL or dead fucking last. And I always thought that was really funny.
And it's very punk rock. Does that date back to ancient times, or is that a more contemporary term?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm going to say ancient times. It's got to be ancient.
I doth think that boat was a dead fucking last. Anyway, yeah, perfect name for a punk band. And I got to tell you, DFL, again, one of my favorite go-to bands. I tend to rediscover them every few years. And, you know, I do binge listening. And very happy to see Proud to Be re-released on Epitaph.
Yeah,
the crazy green
that reissue in 2015.
Yeah, how has that reissue been received? It's been 20 plus years since people have got a new DFL product. A reissue is better than nothing. How's that been received?
Oh, it was great. Yeah, we got a really wonderful reception from pretty much just across the board. So we had like, you know, fans from the 90s that were stoked on it. And then we had, you know, kids that were born after we broke up that were turned on to it. And we got some good reviews from Noisy and punknews.org gave it a staff pick. And so just kind of across the board, you know, it was just really well received, you know, and it's just that type of kind of old-fashioned hardcore that DFL is just known for was just, people were just really glad to hear it again.
Oh, that's great to hear. The next generation is getting turned on to it. And you guys have been playing some shows. I want to get to modern times here in a moment, but first, let's go back a little bit. The band started in 91, and I believe it was you, Crazy Tom, and Adam Horovitz from the Beastie Boys. How do you, this is Beasties around one of the peaks of their career. How do you come to start a band with the Beastie Boy?
The Beastie Boys were in LA working on Check Your Head, and Adam was dating Ione, and Ione was an old friend of ours, and we were all kind of running in the same circles. And the way I got to know Adam was at the time my son my son Bella was probably 6 or 7 months old, and Ione and Adam would babysit Bella, and so they would come over to my house, and they just Ione just loved Bella. So I became friends with Adam, you know, and he would hang out, and you know, it was just really just part of just all of our friends at the time, you know. And one of the times when Adam was hanging around, Ione was hanging around, I was just joking around with Adam, and I said, hey, you know, we should start a hardcore band. And I wrote all these little hardcore songs like Meter Maid and Pizza Man. And he just said, yeah, let's do it. And so one day he just came by my house and said, let's go over to the studio. And I lived near the studio, near G-Sun. And we went over there, and he and I just messed around with the songs. And I think Mike D played drums on them, and we got Tom to sing. And one thing just led to another. And we recorded them, the songs. Mario recorded them. And, you know, just it was just really easy and really natural. And that was about the time that Grand Royal was just getting started, also their label. And they didn't really have any releases or anything like that. And I was in college too. And then I went away for the summer to England to study. And my wife got in touch with me while I was in England. She said, oh, you know, the Beasties put out a DFL single. And I was like, really? And she said, yeah, and Brett Gurewitz heard it, and he really wants to sign DFL to Epitaph. And I was like, really?
What a time to be away.
And I was like, oh. And so I got back to LA, and And so the recordings that we had done, you know, they put out that first single. And so we stuck with Grand Royal for a while. And then when we wanted to put out our next record, we talked with Mike, but Mike D wasn't interested in doing another record with DFL. But we went back and talked with Brett, and Brett Gerwitz was like totally down. So that's when we moved over to Grand Royal in 95.
Epitaph.
And Epitaph in 95. But then we had Adam produce it, and we again recorded it at G-Sun. That's kind of a quickie history.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. Let me go back here and see if I got this right. So when you started the band with Adam, it was yourself, Crazy Tom, and Adam. Mike D came and played drums on that first single, the stuff that's on My Crazy Life. Is that right?
No, he didn't play on the My Crazy Life stuff. He played like the very first practices of DFL, like when we were first working out, like the very first songs. But the first single and the first recordings, Tony Converse played on that, on all of those. So by the time we recorded and we're actually kind of banging out the recordings with Mario, then we had Tony Converse.
So during that time, the Beasties were coming away from Paul's Boutique, which was super sample heavy, and moving towards what their next album was, Check Your Head, which was, you know, instrumentalization. Was that already happening when DFL was starting, or do you think that could have been a bit of an inflection point for the Beasties to perhaps rethink their strategy and their sound?
Well, we met them well after Paul's Boutique, and because I think they did Paul's Boutique all in New York, if I know my Beastie history, and Check Your Head was all done in L.A. So we met them after Paul's Boutique, but I think Paul's Boutique was, you know, kind of their transition from their first record, where it was all, you know, just kind of being, you know, the crazy jackass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of
party frat boy type. Yeah.
Yeah. The License to Ill, where they just blew up and to being like actual, where people were like, well, these guys got something to offer, you know, they're real.
Yeah.
Real artists. But I think that was all done in New York. And then when we met them when I met them in LA, they had already established G-Sun Studios in Atwater, which is near where I live in at the time in Echo Park. You know, it was just a mere, you know, 15-minute drive away. And Mike D was actually living around the corner from my house in Echo Park, like walking distance, with his wife Tamara. And so everybody was close, you know what I mean? It was just like this moment where it was, you know, you look back and you think to yourself, wow, it was just this boom second, you know, you just don't get those every, you know, just this thing just was going on. And you know, and Ione and Adam were together, and you know, and then, like I said, you know, Ione wanted to just come over and babysit, and Adam, you know, loved kids, and then they had set up G-Sun, which was this amazing studio where they recorded Check Your Head and Ill Communication, and you know, they had like, you know, this great control room, plus the studio had like a basketball court in it and a skateboard ramp and a stage with all these amazing instruments and drum sets and amplifiers all set up already. And so it was just this amazing place to go. And then I think creatively, you know, they were just at their peak, you know, recording, and not even just, you know, with sampling, where they had started to realize that they could sample themselves. You know what I mean? That they didn't have to just always sample other artists, but they could start, you know, playing with looping themselves and doing all sorts of interesting stuff, you know, kind of musically and sonically with these songs that they were just creating, in terms of taking hip hop in all sorts of new directions. I mean, you listen to Check Your Head and there's hardcore, there's hip hop. There's, you know, I think there's like some Lee Scratch Perry. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, that's one of my favorite records of all time. And so we were kind of in the midst of that.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And it's not just a musical community as well. I mean, you had people like Spike Jones coming over, and I think he took your initial band promo photos, if I understand the story correctly.
Yeah, he took our promo photos. He took the cover photo for the first 7-inch, you know. Again, you know, he was just coming up and just had like, a, you know, just a shitload of cameras just slung over his neck, and was just shooting photos of everything he could possibly take pictures of, you know, was just hanging out, you know, coming out of that skateboard world, but also in the, you know, hanging out with the Beasties and doing stuff. But yeah, it was a time. It was an amazing time.
The Beasties have always been very experimental in their music. Even before the License to Ill album, they'd been a punk band, and they'd done a lot of experimental stuff. They struck a rich vein of gold with the License to Ill album, and then they went on to Paul's Boutique, of course. And but between Paul's Boutique and Check Your Head, there seems to be a major shift. I would say those are the two albums next to each other that sound the most different. And it's interesting that DFL was in that chasm, and I always assumed played, you know, a significant role, at least in the Beasties rethinking their sound. Because to me personally, DFL also helped me as a young musician reassess my sound, what I was doing. And you know, I was spending a lot of time trying to be I'm not trying to put myself in the Beasties category, but when I discovered DFL, I was at this point where I was spending a lot of time, a lot of effort trying to get the right sound, and it was inhibiting me, I guess, creatively. It's a long time between recording a demo and then getting it properly done. But when I discovered DFL, DFL has this very cool lo-fi sound. You could tell it, you know, people just set up the mics and you guys went for it and didn't overthink it. And it sounded fun. It had lots of energy, and it really made me rethink how I did things. And from that point on, I no longer spent all this time aching over the right reverb sound. It was always like, let's get the thought down right, and let's move the fuck on, you know, let's go to the next thing. And that to me made music much more fun. So I'm wondering if perhaps there was a role played by DFL to help influence or at least accelerate the evolution of the Beastie sound.
Gosh, I would love to say that that DFL had any influence on the Beasties in the smallest possible way, but I have to probably say it probably was the other way around. Because Mario and Adam, when we first started recording, really, I mean, we were very lo-fi, you know, I wrote those hardcore songs, you know, and the music, and Tom and I did the vocals, but Mario and Adam really set the tone for the recording, you know, and we went with it because we, you know, I love recording things quickly and not overthinking recording. So it worked perfectly for us to just record quickly. But I remember that, you know, they wanted to record everything very, very quickly. And for us, for Adam, I mean, for Tom and Tony, there was never any discussion about doing it any other way, you know. And so we just set up all the equipment on the stage. And I remember for the first one, like I said, it wasn't even about recording a record or anything like that. It was just about recording what we were doing. You know, I don't even remember them saying, like, let's record a record. It was just, they just mic'd everything up and we just recorded. And then that was for My Crazy Life. So, you know, but it was all done very lo-fi and very quickly.
Did you play any gigs as that foursome, that original foursome?
Yeah, we did actually. We played a handful of shows with Adam. It was fun too, you know, to play with Adam. You know, kind of during that down period while they were recording Check Your Head, before Check Your Head came out, and of course then they went on the road and, you know, toured the world, etc. But we played like a bar show. There was this one bar that I think my brother was part owner and some of our other friends owned in Hollywood. We played a show there. We played the second stage of Lollapalooza one summer. And wow. we were the first band on the second stage both days of the weekend. and we played with Fugazi also. Yeah, so we played a handful of shows with Adam, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, they obviously had, you know, some connections that they could get sure. us shows easily. And then we played at two shows with the Beastie Boys. One was a benefit that they did. We organized a benefit for this local needle exchange, and they played it as Quasar, and then we did another show with them in Hawaii, which was awesome.
Now, while you're in this universe, I mean, the Beastie Boys is a huge machine. I'm sure there's the people beyond the two Adams and the Mike D that, you know, they need the guys to be making some decisions and putting together a new album and kind of going on to the next phase of their career. Did you ever feel any pressure that perhaps DFL was becoming a distraction?
No, because Adam was always very upfront with us. Horovitz was always very upfront with us that, you know, hey, you know, I've got, you know, obviously I've got to, you know, the Beasties is my primary thing that I have to do. So you guys need to be thinking about getting another bass player if you want to start doing DFL as like going from just being like a fun kind of thing that we're just doing here in LA, you know, kind of goofing around, to taking it to the next level, which is I kind of look at the next level as being like with Epitaph, where we started to really get serious about being a band, you know, as opposed to when we were doing it with Grand Royal, which was kind of just kind of fun, and we were messing around and having a good time with it. Not that we didn't have a good time with it with Epitaph as well, but it wasn't like, you know, thinking about like touring and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And taking it up to the next level. So that's when we got a different bass player.
Did you stay on Grand Royal after Adam left the band, or was it pretty much simultaneous with the move to Epitaph?
Pretty much simultaneous, you know. It was around the time that we made the move to Epitaph is when we also were like, you know, if, you know, Adam was getting really busy, I think, with, you know, the, like you said, the machine was gearing up for, you know, Check Your Head and all that kind of stuff was going on. But I'm trying to remember back. I mean, but he did have time to work with us for a good week or two on Proud to Be. So clearly he had time. So that I remember we went back to G-Sun and worked on that for a good week or two. And then I remember he came back to town and we played him the mixes for it, and then played the sequence of the songs, you know, and played them like, what do you think about this sequence of songs? And then there's also a live song, some live songs from the Huntridge Theater that we threw in to ask him what he thought about that. And, you know, and he thought like, oh, you know, this is good. And that's, you know, what do you think of this? And remember he was playing a show, the BCs were playing a show in Santa Barbara. So we drove him up to the show in Santa Barbara and played him the sequence of the record and the mixes and stuff. Well, I mean, he mixed it, but him and Mario mixed it also, but we kind of played the sequence and talked with him about the stuff. And so
when you start having the conversations with Brett Gurewitz of Epitaph, now, again, you mentioned early on Grand Royal put out those recordings while you were overseas. Brett Gurewitz was interested, but of course you guys are sticking with Grand Royal because, well, that's where you were at. That was Adam's, you know, part owner of that label. It made sense to stay there. After Adam left the band, you got a new bass player. You went back to Brett Gurewitz. Was the conversation any different, or was he still equally down with DFL no matter what the lineup was?
Yeah, no different. No different. Brett was into the music. You know, I don't think he was into, I don't think it was a question of who was in the band per se, that he really, I always got the feeling that he really liked the music. I don't remember there being any question about it. The only question that he had at the time was only hesitation he had was he wanted to talk with Mike D to make sure that we weren't fucking over Mike D by leaving Grand Royal. So he wanted Mike D's blessing, something like that. You know, he wanted to make sure that it was okay with Mike that we were leaving. And so he wanted to talk. He wanted to talk with Mike. And so he and Mike had, I guess, had a chat at some point before we left, make sure that everything was sure. And so, and then, you know, and I think Mike was okay with us leaving, is, you know, that I think Mike wanted to focus more on some of the other bands than us. So I think ultimately Epitaph was a better home for us because it was like a punk label.
And one other last gift that was from that My Crazy Life era was the Knucklehead logo, which is still part of the DFL style today. It's on skateboards and T-shirts all over the place. Where did the Knucklehead logo come from?
Well, that's kind of the gift that keeps on giving, right? That was an idea that Adam Horovitz had. For he, in his mind's eye, I remember him telling me, like, saying, like, Monty, I've got this idea for the DFL logo with a smile with the DFL in its teeth. And he's like, I have a friend in New York that's an artist named Shay, I think the guy's name was, said, I'm going to ask Shay to draw something. And that's where it came from. So Adam asked his friend Shay to draw it, and then Shay did something, and then Tom and I bought it. Mm. You know, after it was drawn up, Tom and I bought the rights to it.
Out of curiosity, how much did you initially pay for the Knucklehead logo rights?
I think we bought it for like $500.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
And that logo, that's been a very good investment. I mean, that's really stuck with you guys for years and years. I see people with tattoos of it and all sorts of things. You got to be happy about that, yeah?
Yeah. No, it's been one of those logos that there's all sorts of logos out there for punk bands, and you know, we're really fortunate that we have one that our fans seem to really appreciate. And I'm just blown away when I see people with the Knucklehead tattoo, you know. And you know, we have a little web store, and we, you know, and the T-shirt, people want to buy it all over the world. And
Iron Maiden has Eddie, and you guys have the Knucklehead.
yeah. Or I think, like, you know, the Descendants have their little Milo, and Rancid has, and NoFX has, you know, and different bands have theirs, you know. So, you know, and I've you know, seen, like, on, you know, people's tattoos, you know, and just in punk rock, you know, and you'll see the Knucklehead kind of creeping into, like, the other punk rock, you know, kind of icons out there, you know, little by little, especially since we've been starting to play more.
Moving into the Epitaph years, Proud to Be was recorded, again, at G-Son, still has that kind of flavor. Adam stuck around for the production, some of the consulting, and being a friendly set of ears for that one. But then you guys started touring the world, really, opening up for the likes of Slayer, Sublime, a whole bunch of other bands. What was it like then moving from the My Crazy Life era, where it heavily rotated around Los Angeles, to then Proud to Be, where you guys were going anywhere and everywhere?
You know, like you said, you know, we went from, you know, My Crazy Life, where it was like, you know, playing local shows around LA, and it being more of like a kind of doing it for fun, so to speak, to jumping into the Epitaph world, where now it was like, you know, it was, the expectations were a little bit higher. Money was starting to get involved too. You know, at Grand Royal, you know, money wasn't really a thing, you know, that it was just like a kind of on a handshake kind of, I mean, there was a little contract, but really, you know, we weren't really making any money off of what we put out there at that time. Where when we signed with Epitaph, it was, you know, again, DFL has always you know, back then was really in the right place at the right time a lot. And so we were at the right time with the Beasties when they set up shop for, you know, G-Sun and for Grand Royal. And then we were at the right place when Epitaph, you know, basically struck punk rock gold with the Offspring. And all of a sudden, you know, we were there in 95 when Brett Gurewitz became, you know, when Epitaph went from just being like a little mom and pop place to having, you know, sold like, I don't know, 100 million records on with Offspring and became very wealthy. And he, Brett was, you know, a very generous person and really funded all of the, you know, gave us a pretty decent deal for being a punk rock band, you know, a little hardcore band, and gave us a lot of tour support that was, you know, that they call like non-recoupable punk rock, tour support. So we could be out on the road and you know, had a nice van and were able to, you know, stay in halfway decent places and stuff. And we had a good manager that got us those tours with Sublime and Slayer and stuff. So we had a lot of stuff going for us. But also, you know, being away, you know, for at 6 weeks at a time, you know, takes its toll on you, you know, and people, I think it wore down people. It, you know, caused some stress amongst people in the band. And ultimately, I think there was some infighting amongst folks, poor communication. And ultimately, on the heels of our second record on Epitaph, you know, our singer quit, and it was kind of a house of cards from there.
Mm. And when you say singer, you're one of the primary voices. You talking Crazy Tom?
Yeah. So ultimately, you know, Tom, we did a little mini tour before Grateful was going to come out, and of South America, and Tom was unhappy, and he quit, and that was. But you know, it wasn't just Tom. You know, it's a band is like a marriage. You know, except for you're married to four people or married to each other.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a relationship where, you know, people have to get along with each other and you have to communicate, and there's functional relationships and dysfunctional relationships. And unfortunately, DFL became, you know, pretty dysfunctional, and you know, and Tom's quitting, I think, was just the stick that broke the camel's back. So it wasn't his fault per se. It was everybody had a role to play in terms of things falling apart. So, but
well, as you say, you know, a band is, yeah, I guess probably one of the closest things you can compare it to is a marriage, and you need communication, you need all these different things to keep it going. You need to be able to say the truths or be in a safe place to where you can at least have a conversation to discuss things. When you combine it with being on the road, likely money and budget pressures, lack of sleep, and then wrap that all up with just people being young, the youth of
yeah.
it all, you know, it's really hard to navigate those sort of waters. So again, yeah, no fault to anyone who ends up leaving a band or gets frustrated and thinks they're making perhaps a right decision or they're making a decision based on emotion, because that's all they know at that point. So again, it's unfortunate that it happens, but you and Tom did eventually make up and actually recently got back together. Why the reformation of DFL after 20 something years?
You know, that's a good question. I, you know, Tom and, you know, we had been broken up actually 17 years when Tom came back, and, you know, and he and I were, you know, had kind of made our peace after about, you know, I didn't really see him, you know, for the time that we were broken up, but we had made our peace. I'd made my peace with Tony too. You know, he and I, the three of us had kind of gotten together and thought about reforming, you know, a couple of years before then, and thought, man, I don't know. And I had played guitar once in Tom's other band, GFP. He had asked me to kind of do a guest appearance to play on this one show. And then I just really kind of, you know, but I'd never really thought, you know, after about 5 or 6 years, I'd really figured, you know, DFL is, you know, is not coming back. And I'm not exactly sure why Tom decided to, you know, come knocking on my door after 17 years. I think he was in GFP and, you know, his other band. And I think that he was looking for a change of pace with GFP. And, I don't know, came talk with me. And for me, it was a really good time in my life. You know, my kids were older, and I was, the career that I had started after DFL was at a good point where I could focus on something else. And, pretty much out of the blue, you know, and I mean, I had literally not played my guitar, punk rock guitar, for many, many years, but fortunately I had kept my original guitar and amp from the DFL days, because there were two things that I've just kept for my whole life. And so had to get them tuned up and repaired, and some things, you know, had gotten pretty funky over the years, but, it was pretty out of, for me, it was way out of the blue. And, and
it is back to very strong form. You had that one track for, I believe it was punknews.org that you premiered it on a few months ago. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like getting back together and recording with the band after 20 years?
Yeah. You know, that was a little scary, you know, because when we decided to start writing music again, my attitude was, and I talked with Tom, was like, hey, you know, we don't want DFL to become a different band. We want to stay close to our roots. And so it was a little scary, like, what's the music going to be like? Is it, you know, are we going to all of a sudden become like a different band, or who knows what it's going to sound like? And, you know, we wrote a couple songs, and they all sounded like old DFL, and we were really stoked. And we chose that one and went with it, recorded in very much the same way, you know, banged out that song in, like, you know, just basically one day, kept it real quick, real lo-fi, and really stuck to the DFL kind of aesthetic in terms of not overthinking it. And that's what we're doing now with this new record that we're doing with Hetson, is, you know, we've got another like six or seven songs, and I think we'll probably include that song, which is Shut It Down, on this record as well. But again, you know, we recorded, I think, about five or six songs, did the guitar, bass, and drums tracks. Recorded all of them in one day. Now we're doing vocals and some lead guitar overdubs, and again, doing them really quickly, not doing a lot of, you know, thinking it over, you know, do one or two takes, pick the best take, move on.
And it's nice to see you currently recording with Greg Hetson. Of course, he's, you know, from many years with Bad Religion and Circle Jerks and heaps of other punk projects. Is he doing production, advisory? What's his role in the new DFL recordings?
Yeah, you know, he's doing some of the production. You know, he's doing some Pro Tools. He's doing, I think, a little bit of what a traditional producer would do, which is saying, like, why don't you try it this way? Why don't you try it that way? And, you know, just kind of just being there as well, you know, in terms of, kind of, you know, he's a fellow guitar player, so he can also give his overview in terms to me, you know, in terms of saying, like, well, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? You know, and we're also doing some recording at one studio, and now we're doing some of the recording at his studio. So
that's awesome. And when do you think we're going to be able to hear a new DFL album?
Well, like I said, probably late 2017 at the earliest, sometime in 2018, probably more realistic.
Oh, that sounds awesome, Monty. I can't wait to hear that. The song Shut It Down, people can Google online and check it out, hear the first DFL in 20 years. Again, it's got that same energy, that same vibe. It's like they never stopped. It's like a little piece of my youth coming back to smile at me. It sounds just like DFL back in the day, and I can't wait to hear the new stuff you guys are doing with Hetson. So hurry up and release that, will you? Do you have a record label by chance that you're working with? with right now, or is that still something that's in the works?
That's something that's in the works. We have a couple record labels that have expressed interest in the project. You know, we're talking with that, but we're also kind of leaving it open for negotiations with other labels. So yeah, we're open. We're open right now.
You've also got the rights to the My Crazy Life period that you purchased back from Grand Royal after they went broke. Is that right? So it could be a package deal if you work it out with a particular label.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Grand Royal went bankrupt in like the 2000s, and the whole catalog minus Beastie Boys was purchased by another third party that wasn't really a record label, kind of a media company. And I approached them after we got back together, and they had everything online called GR2, GR2.com, and they just weren't doing a lot with it. And I got in touch with them, and I said, hey, you know, we're back together, blah, blah, blah. Would you be interested in doing anything? And like I said, they were not doing a lot. So finally I said to them, would you be interested in selling us back the masters and the license? And they basically said, yeah, no problem. And so I bought the masters to My Crazy Life and all the licenses. They actually had the original 2-inch tapes that we recorded at GSUN, and which are awesome. And they also have some unreleased live recordings too that I purchased that DFL had done back then as well. Plus all the licenses to the recordings for My Crazy Life.
That's interesting.
I was able to purchase all that, which no matter what happens to it, I just want to say this, no matter what happens, if a record label comes along and wants to put it out again, that would be great. I'm totally open to that. But one of my big regrets in my musical career was back in the 2000s, because I was party to doing business with Grand Royal, as is my other people in DFL, and I imagine other bands on Grand Royal, I got letters from the bankruptcy court saying, hey, you know, Grand Royal's in bankruptcy. If you want to come down and bid on any of this stuff, it's going to the bank, you know, they're in bankruptcy right now. And at the time, unfortunately, I just didn't have the funds or the will to get down there and do it. So I always regretted not grabbing this stuff when I had the chance. Mm-hmm. And so at least now I feel like the DFL, My Crazy Life, and the masters and everything are back with the band. So that really makes me feel good.
You're very lucky. That's a 1,000-to-1 shot at that point that they would ever come back or be up for sale for any affordable price after the auction.
Yeah, I really worried that this company was going to be dicks, and the company, actually this media company that had GR2, they were really nice, and they said, you know, hey, you know, you could probably do more with this stuff than we can, and we want them to be back with the band. And so they sold them to me for you know, I thought I'd have to go to Brett Gerwitz or somebody and be like, hey, come on, let's do a deal, a partnership or something, or have to find some partners or something to raise some funds. And they actually sold them to me for a very reasonable price so that I could purchase them on my own. So now I feel like, you know, win, lose, or draw, you know, hopefully I can reissue them. I'd love to find a label to reissue them with, and get them back out there. I mean, right now I put them back on digital media, so they're available on iTunes and Amazon and whatnot. But I'd love to get them, you know, out again on vinyl. So hopefully that'll happen someday. But even if that never happens, you know, at least I feel like, you know, I mean, it sounds silly, but at least I feel like they're back with the band.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The cycle is complete. That's that's very nice. And you got a bunch of extras, too, that you probably forgot about or didn't know existed. The live stuff, some outtakes. So hopefully it's not just the original form of My Crazy Life that we see, but also an expanded version with some extra goodies in there as well. So, Monty, appreciate you spending time with us. As you know, whenever we do an interview, we often, you know, share it that we're doing it on social media, and we send out emails to listeners, that sort of thing, to send us your questions for the band. So we got a few questions from DFL and vinyl collectors. You got a few minutes for these?
Sure. Shoot.
Cool. All right. Adam DeBonca asked, Monty, is there any connection left with the band and any member of the Beastie Boys?
You know, I personally, I haven't been in touch with the Beasties in 20 odd years, but I know Tom, you know, Tom is in touch with Mike, and I think he's in touch with Adam too, you know. So I think so, you know, I think I definitely know that Tom sees Mike and stuff, that they're Tom's sister Tamara was married to Mike for many years. I think that they're divorced now, but I know that they Tamara and Mike still have kids together, and they raise them, and Mike's their uncle, and he sees them, and so I know that I know Tom is still in touch with all those guys.
So there's still kind of those remnants of those previous social circles.
Yeah, and who knows, maybe one day I'll get back in touch with Adam Horovitz. I don't know. I heard he moved back to L.A. Maybe I'll see him.
All right, cool. Next question, Aaron from Huntington Beach. Proud to Be is known as Proud to Be on CD and I think cassette. However, in vinyl format, it's known as Tony's War. Why the change-up of naming between the formats?
You know, Tony Converse, our drummer, really fought hard to have it done on vinyl, but in vinyl in this particular format where it was 2 7-inches, and it also had to be mastered in a certain way, and it had to just be this certain format, and it was like a big fight that Tony had to have it this certain format. So we decided to call it Tony's War because he fought really hard to have it done this certain way. So it was kind of like a tip of the hat to Tony and his fight to have it done in a certain way. And also you could see like the if you look closely at the vinyl, when you have it mastered onto wax, you can sign the wax also. And so each of us signed the actual vinyl masters when they cut them. So on the center piece, the center part, that's where there's no audio, but where it spins.
The runout groove, yeah.
Yeah, you can actually write on that part. So each one of us signed that. So there's like four for each of the two. There's like two records, but then there's four areas where you can sign it. So each one of us wrote our name there too. So it was very much hands-on kind of thing that he had to do. It had to be mastered at a particular place with a particular guy that was like a expert audio mastering guy. And so it was a war that Tony had to fight.
Now, was Tony also the guy that, because that wasn't the last time you guys had a different name for different formats. Grateful was known as the Tape Show as well. Same songs, I think different order. Was that was Tony's hand all over that as well?
Tony's hand was all over part of Grateful, but the Tape Show, we just decided to do that as kind of like as if you were going to do like a mixtape for like a your friend, you know, so we decided to just do like this crazy mixtape. And so I think that was just like the band just decided to do that. I can't remember whose idea it was exactly, but and we just decided like, hey, let's just make Grateful into like in cassette version. And we always decided to try to do things, you know, mix things up and do things in different formats, and you know, and give our fans like lots of different things to kind of, I guess, enjoy, get, you know, whatever. And so that's why, you know, that one's kind of, again, the sequencing is different. There's like a lot of different tracks on there. There's outtakes. There's bands actually on there playing DFL covers off of Proud to Be. There's just all sorts of random shit. And it was just meant to be like, hey, here's my mixtape of like some weird DFL shit, you know. And cool thing about that is that I can kind of do like a little reveal on your podcast, that we have a release date for the reissue of the tape show. This year is the 20th anniversary of the release of the tape show and of Grateful. And Burger Records is doing a 20th anniversary reissue of the cassette version. So it's just of the tape show. And that's going to be coming out on October 13th on Burger Records.
Far out. Okay. But that only cassette? For now, is that
what, yeah, I understand? Just the cassette.
Okay.
All right. So it's just the cassette of the tape show, and that's going to be out on Burger Record on October 13th, which I think is the day before tape show cassette store day.
Oh, okay, that's fantastic, because the tape show right now I believe is quite collectible. It's quite expensive to get a copy of the tape show.
Yeah, right? Okay. Yeah, yeah. Actually, I didn't even have a copy of it. So the copy that I had digitized and sent to Burger, I had to buy myself off of, I think, Discogs. And I think I bought a copy for $40. But I did see one copy a while ago for $100. I think that this issue might fuck up that market. But who knows? Again, these are going to be Burger reissues, not the real Epitaph one from '97. But yeah, so that's going to be a reissue that's coming out on October 13th.
Oh, sweet. Okay, we'll definitely be sharing that quite a bit. And my question, really, any hope to see Grateful available on vinyl?
That's an Epitaph question. So I would say that's probably not anything that's going to happen. I mean, the 20th anniversary reissue of Proud to Be was a pretty incredible feat in itself. That was the moonshot. And then the reissue of the tape show, I did talk with Brett, because Brett had to green light this because it is an Epitaph release, and Brett basically said the only label that can do it is Burger. So he basically said that he will only give permission for Burger Records to reissue the tape show on cassette.
Okay.
So we'll see. You never know. You know, it's Brett has always had a real soft spot for DFL, so maybe he will allow Grateful to be reissued on vinyl one day. But you never know.
I would absolutely love that. And another question, the Grateful CD, it was all one track, and yeah, you couldn't skip from song to song to song. You pretty much had to start from the very beginning and either, you know, kind of manually fast forward or just listen to the whole thing. Not a bad option, but still sometimes a pain in the ass. What was that a screw up in terms of the CD mastering, or was that by intent?
So that was Tony Converse, if my memory serves.
Tony sounds like a real pain in the ass.
If memory serves, that was Tony. Tony felt like it needed to be like one album, just like one thing. And I was at, that was another mastering thing when they were mastering, and my wife had made plans to take our family to Disneyland that day, and so I couldn't be at mastering that particular day. And so it's not something that I would have done, because again, I felt like from a kind of pragmatic point of view, it was a little bit of a pain, or a lot of a pain. But Tony made that choice while I wasn't there, so which was kind of a crazy choice to make. And I just remember being like, God damn it, that's, while I was at Disneyland, Tony decided to put All Grateful as one track. So that was his
Well, you were on Pirates of the Caribbean. He was making this horrible choice for the band.
Yeah, I was on Small World after all, and he was deciding to be Grateful. I mean, to him, I think he thought it was like an awesome choice, you know, kind of artistic. But it was, I think, kind of a unilateral choice that I probably would have disagreed with. But in the, you know, people have like chopped it up into multiple tracks. I've seen it posted on YouTube in multiple tracks. And
I did that back in the day but I'm pretty good with audio. So this is like, yeah, I imported into Sound Designer, like a Pro Tools thing, chopped it up, burned my own CD on the CD player. I had the skills to be able to do that back in the day. I mean, everybody has them now, but yeah, that, I just imagine so many people just getting frustrated with that.
Well, it's like, you know, how do you find, like, you're like, I really like this song, which is like five songs in, but I don't like the one that's four songs in or whatever. And you're having to, like, you know, wait it out or something, you know?
Oh, totally. Totally. You know, I know the songs on Grateful by how the previous song ends. Like, yeah. You know, there's the one, Monty, Monty, someone's banging on the door, then get a job. It's like, that's the song, you know. I don't know the names of the songs, but I just know their sequence and how they seg into one another. All right, Monty, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, really appreciate you taking the time, and very excited to hear you guys are in the studio recording again, and hopefully, you know, a bunch of young musicians and music lovers are going to hear the latest DFL and get as inspired with it, certainly as I did. I want to give you call attention to a few things that are happening in the DFL world. The 20th anniversary of the Tape Show is being released on October 13th through Burger Records. You could either go to Burger Records website, or probably better yet, go to facebook.com/proudtobeDFL. That's obviously their Facebook page, and I'm sure Monty and team are going to be putting links up on where to buy it. Not only the 20th anniversary of the Tape Show, but also any new tracks they have coming up, the new recordings or the reissue of My Crazy Life. So keep up with your DFL news at facebook.com/proudtobeDFL. Again, Monty, thank you so much for being on the show, and look forward to hearing the new tunes.
All right. Thanks, Nate. Thanks for chatting with me. Take care.
Good. Cheers. All right. Thank you again, Monty, for coming on The Vinyl Guide, sharing some of those incredible stories. You've had some amazing adventures and produced some fantastic music. So everyone, if you don't already, go over to Facebook and like DFL's Facebook page, facebook.com/proudtobeDFL. They always have news up there and sound clippets and stuff they're working on. You could always get a copy of the Tape Show re-release that's coming out on cassette store day, I think October 13th or 14th, around there. Put on your wish list the new DFL album that's being produced by Greg Hetson. And of course, if you happen to have connections over at Epitaph Records, please, please, please convince Brett Gurewitz to re-release Grateful on vinyl. I think that's one of my serious holy grails, a serious gap in my collection that I'd love to see filled at some point. So there we go. facebook.com/proudtobeDFL. All right, and that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for joining us. We do appreciate it. Make sure you subscribe. Tell a couple of your music record weirdo friends about this podcast. That's always helpful in growing the Vinyl Guide community. We'll be back next week with episode 96. We're almost at 100. It's going to be exciting. So again, we have a brand new episode next week. We'll see you then. Until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.